Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Okay, well, welcome back. As is our custom, we'll go around at this time and introduce ourselves to each other. I'm Marvin Snow.
Mark Tilly.
Rainey.
Todd Pope.
Kevin.
Umeboshi.
John.
Kay Matsuda.
John Gardner.
Jean Day.
Jack Busby.
Howard DeCourt.
William Maggi.
Peter.
Larry Wish.
Corbett.
Jim Craig.
Carl Wolf.
David Lewis.
Paul Hunter.
Baruch Golden.
Raj.
Andre.
Mike LeBrie.
Clint.
George.
Robert Banks.
Mark.
Stephen Chan.
Lee Robbins.
Mark.
Dave Dyer.
Jerry Jones.
Dave.
Paul Winter.
Luke.
Louis.
Hunter McWhitten.
David Axel.
Shannon.
Scott.
And Brent.
Will.
Paul Shepard.
Peter.
David.
Will.
Harley Shapiro.
Mitch.
Guillermo.
Hey, welcome everybody. Is anyone here for the first or second time or returning after a long absence? Could you reintroduce yourself just so everybody can recognize
you? I'm Raj.
Raj, welcome.
Shannon.
Shannon, welcome. The longer term member, oh, one more.
Mark.
Mark.
This one over here.
Yeah. And the name?
Guillermo.
Okay. Well,
and Lewis.
Lewis, okay.
The other one over here.
Okay, well, quite a few new people, welcome, and the people who have been here for a longer time will be pleased to meet with you and talk with you in a social time after the from time to time, the Sangha has a couple of members speak to us about their lives, their life journey, their spiritual journey. The story that they tell is pretty much their story, their choice. And I wanted to, by way of introduction for Doug and Carl, Doug Hall and Carl Zanya, I want to just make brief reference to a book I read over the holidays, From Boys to Men. It's an anthology of gay men write about growing up. Well, our stories here in the Sangha go beyond just the phase of growing up, but go get well into our adult lives. And reading this book made me realize how valuable the website is. On that website, you can browse and find many of the past Dharma Duo talks that have been given here. And as time permits, I encourage you to do that. Each one is unique, and they're all enlightening in their own way. So with that introduction, I would like to turn the talk over to Doug. Are you going to speak first? And then after Doug will speak for about 20 minutes. Carl will speak for another 20 minutes, and then we'll have a short period of questions and answers. Okay, Doug, floor is yours.
Thank you. Well, what a great time of year this is. We're going into the dark, and we're having all of these cleansing storms. And, you know, then it's a new beginning. And I was born at this time of year, almost smack on the winter solstice. And it was near midnight, a dark, cold night in a little American town called Laramie, Wyoming, which growing up I was always very proud of. And could tell kids and you'd say, see this scar here, you know, because there were Indians attacking the house when I was born, you know, and they would believe it. But of course, now it has another connotation. But I only lived there until I was 16 months old. My mother had gone there. She had a very dear aunt, a married aunt, who had a family. and my father was off in World War II. And so I had my mother all to myself there for 16 months. And my dad came back from the war. He had very hard duty the whole time, was in Kaneohe Bay on Oahu at a base there. And but it seems like, you know, my mother always thought I was about the greatest thing that ever walked on this earth. My father never did. In fact, there was a lot of disapproval, and it may have started there at that 16 months when he all of a sudden intruded into this thing that my mother and I had going. My dad stayed in the career as the Navy, and we lived in really beautiful places. My earliest memories are in Washington, D.C., where my sister and only sibling was born. And then we lived in two Navy towns on Chesapeake Bay in Virginia. And this was in the early 50s. It was just a beautiful place there, you know, Williamsburg and the beaches and the Blue Ridge Mountains, and we always took advantage of those. And then in the mid-50s, we lived in Italy, in Naples, and it was a very, very happy time for us. That was like fourth, fifth, and sixth grades for me. And the first year we lived up on a hill called Basilipo, a ritzy part of the city of Naples, and we had a view out over the Bay of Naples with Vesuvius and the whole city below us. And the second year, later in the period, we moved out to a part in the western Bay of Naples that was also just a wonderful place with Roman ruins, and we had a volcano, inactive little volcano behind our house, and we had a beach in front of our house. It was just a beautiful time to be in Italy and to be in Europe, and the American dollar was king, and we saw Europe, and we even drove our big American car all the way up to Scotland to visit relatives. And then after Italy, we lived in Washington State in the Puget Sound area, which is where I went to high school and junior high school. And we lived we had a place out in the country on 5 acres, and we had beautiful view across the Green Valley to see out to the Olympic Mountains, which is these beautiful, like, Switzerland-type mountains. And I was in the Boy Scouts and really loved it all the way through Eagle. And we would do nine-day backpacks through the Olympic National Park. And as we walked along, we didn't need canteens. We just had these little Boy Scout cups. And you'd come to a stream every few, just a little ways, and you could just dip it out and drink it. I mean, that's the way the West was at this time. So I think I was sort of spoiled by, although of course I took it for granted as a child, but living in these beautiful places, that really the beauty was a real solace to me, because I've heard some people say, well, you know, they got confused like when they were teenagers about what was going on. But before I started the first grade, I looked at I think it was a Sunday funny papers, and there was a picture there, and I felt a sort of stirring below when I looked at this picture, and I knew this wasn't right, and I knew I couldn't tell anyone. And I knew that this was something I would have to change. So I always carried this inside, this secret, because, of course, in those days, nobody talked about it, and it was nowhere. It was not on TV or anywhere. And, you know, on top of this, I had my father telling me, you know, you're no good, you've got all these flaws, you know, you're never going to be a success in life. Now, what he meant was, I don't like your behavior now, and so I'm exaggerating so that you'll change. But of course, the message comes true that and creates a great deal of fear about the future. And so I always live with this fear, and I live with the knowledge, you know, oh, you don't know the half of it, Dad, you know, if you only really knew. But it made me go into this to become a real high achiever. There's a book written by a gay man that I love called The Best Little Boy. I think that's the title. It's something like that. And that was me. I was always straight A's, you know, the teachers loved me, and always excelling. And the kids liked me too, because I wasn't arrogant, because I knew underneath that I had this big flaw. But and so it continued. You know, and in high school, I was a really big man. I fortunately for the high school society, I could never do the ball sports, which is where the real sports heroes of course, are in high school. But I could do track, and I was really good at the high hurdles and other things. And so for several years, I was high point man on our high school track team. And among many other exploits, I was student body vice president and president. But I would stand up there at those assemblies. We had a student body of close to 1,000, you know, thinking, you know, oh, this is great, all this power and glory would vanish, you know, if you only knew this thing about me that I was working to change and really couldn't accept. So then I came down to college here in the Bay Area to California for the first time. And at that time, the population of California was only 16 million, and it was a very beautiful, beautiful place here. And I came to a prominent Bay Area university with a gorgeous campus and about the best climate on the peninsula. Well, it's on the peninsula. It's the best climate in the Bay Area. That was a fairly happy time for me. I got into the fraternity I wanted. I had friends. And I stayed there for 10 years because, a lot of my fraternity brothers, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I wanted to drop out. But my fraternity brothers, a lot of them were going to law school. And I got into the university's law school, which a lot of them would have really liked to get into. So I thought I might as well do it. I hated it, absolutely hated it. It was one of the worst years of my life. But I couldn't quit. And so I told my draft board I was changing majors in graduate school, and they bought it. And so I stayed there and eventually got a PhD in communication research because I had to stay in there because of the Vietnam War. And at one point, it even got so close that I had to take a physical in Oakland and, you know, to do the big Army physical and go through that. It's like, whoa. And also, during this time, you know, I was doing some reading, and one really influential book was The Population Bomb. And that has influenced my view of what has happened and the future. Of course, not everything that was in that book happened the way it said, but I have always believed, and it seems to me it is happening. But I was also, you know, reading about meditation, and I would read these books, like Alan Watts was big at that time, and of course Ram Dass, you know, and Be Here Now is one of my favorite books, and also I got into Carlos Castaneda and Hermann Hesse novels, all this spiritual stuff. And I was very interested in it, and I thought, yeah, this meditation, yeah, this is something I should do, you know, but I didn't do it. I just would just read about it. So anyway, after I got out, I ended up working at a nonprofit research institute that was near the university. And it was really very idyllic work in many ways. The people were great, and there was travel and writing and lots of interesting work and great people to work with. And I was still reading about meditation, and I finally, at this point, gave up. I had lost my virginity with a woman and had had a 2-year relationship with another woman, but I gave up and enjoyed the 70s and the wild sex. Moved up to San Francisco and had a great time in the 70s. The first money I got, I bought a place in San Francisco. It was very important to me that I have a place, a beautiful place to live, because, again, I think because of this fear that, you know, I would be lucky if I had a hole to live in, because my father told me. So in the 80s, and about the same time, I inherited this beautiful property in Santa Barbara. And I went down there to live because the research institute, it was great work, but as you got more senior, you became less secure because it's all proposals and new funding coming in. And I ended up living down there, and I was tired of the all the mine stuff. But I sort of inherited two people from this relative I inherited the property from. One was this wheeler-dealer businessman, and he was going to bring all this money in very soon. So that, like, even because I inherited the property but no money, and that sort of rationalized, well, you know, if all this $50 million's coming in next Tuesday at the latest, you know, might as well. So that went on and on, and nothing ever came of it. But also there was an employee there, a wonderful guy, who had worked for my uncle, and we did all of this remodeling on this old house and plumbing and electrical, and I was the designer, and he was sort of the, you know, the skilled craftsman, and I would assist him and the engineer. So that was a fairly happy time. And then I finally gave up on the business deals and really couldn't afford to just continue living down there. But I had become a sort of small-time real estate developer. The property up here, fortunately, I had condos, three flats, and the property down there, I had done a parcel split, which it was a good time to do it because it's impossible to do it now. And so I came back up to the city, and finally, that's when I started meditation, around 89. I went to a weekend with Jack Kornfield down at a place in the Santa Cruz Hills. And just a few weeks after that, the earth moved. We had the quake of 89, so I thought there must be something to Buddhism. And also about that time, I'd had this 7 or 8 year relationship with this guy in the 70s, and I came back up, and shortly thereafter, in 1990, he died very unexpectedly and very quickly of AIDS. And I went into a real AIDS panic myself, even though the tests were negative. I mean, rationally I knew, but irrationally I was convinced I had something that the test didn't show. So I went through this for quite a few months. But the reason I mention it is because I was thinking I was going to die, and one of the things I was regretting is that I had never had a chance to develop this meditation and this spiritual practice. So that was another motivator to get in there and do it. And also at this time, I joined GBF, and I think it must have been shortly after it was organized over in the Zen Hospice. And I've been coming ever since, and it's been, along with Spirit Rock, it's been a very, very important part of my life, and I come whenever I'm here in the city and have, you know, gone on our retreats and gone on the Spirit Rock retreats. One thing I'd like to share with you about my practice and about the retreats, I was aware that sometimes people get these sort of highs on the retreats, and I had decided, well, that was sort of something I would like to experience, even though the teachers don't emphasize it, and it's really not the point, and so on and so on. But I did at one retreat really bear down, and I got into this, you know, tearful joy and everything, and it lasted about 2 days after the retreat ended, and I was walking around the streets just brimming with love and compassion for the bombs and for everybody, you know. And then I came down. But I was glad that I experienced it. So the thing about Buddhism, one of my favorite aspects of Buddhism that I don't think gets enough emphasis is this idea of the equality of all that lives. And it seems to me, as of the major religions, that Buddhism has this idea in a more central place of the importance of the environment and the respect for others. Like when you go on a retreat and you're encouraged not to step on the ants. And books like Peter Matheson's The Snow Leopard, where the only snow leopards that survive are around the Buddhist monastery because the people don't kill, because it's a de facto wildlife refuge. And, you know, because I've lived in beautiful places and I've also had the blessing to travel extensively most of my life, I've seen how the world is changing as our world population has more than doubled in my lifetime. I go back to places and I see these. And we're adding another San Francisco every 2 or 3 days, enough that many people. And, you know, obviously, you know, the world, we've got to stop this. And because the more people there are, it's a finite world, the more people there are, other living things, has got to be less. And it seems to me this is a very core thing in Buddhism, and this is something that I really appreciate about Buddhism, that it recognizes this. That's it.
Thank you.
there's this woman in my building named Catherine, this little black woman. She always walks up to me with a frown. She goes, "Why are you always so happy?" I was born Carl Leo Minns in June of 63, which makes me a very watery Cancer. My father was born into what I call a drunken Irishman heritage. My mother and him met in the Marines. They were both Marines. And he knocked her up. They got married and had me. And after I was born, I had a little brother that was born. And at 2 years old, my mother decided that she was not able at 20 years old. She was no longer capable of living with a drunk, depressed ex-soldier. And she left. She left two little boys with my father. And after realizing he couldn't take care of two little boys on his own, he shipped us to California, where my grandmother was also eking out a new life with her third husband there. And my father eventually moved out to California after he'd settled his affairs in New England and remarried a woman that had three children of her own, who were by that time almost in their early teens, and they had two more children. So at one point there were seven children and two adults living in kind of pretty intense poverty in Santa Ana, California. When my father realized that something was not working very well under the situation, so he put my brother and I back in the household under the care of my grandmother. So my father's family heritage being that of Catholicism, and when we were all living together under this same house, we were under the influence of these people across the street, the Earharts, who were very Catholic to the degree that they had 13 children. So my first, I did actually attend 1 year of Catholic school, first grade. So when I did go back and live with my grandmother, my brother and I, again, we were raised under very strict and ritualistic Catholic household. We said prayer at dinner at every meal. We went to church every Sunday, catechism, the whole shebang. I did First Communion, and shortly after I did First Communion, there was a lot of grief in the household. My grandmother was very ill, and I adored her deeply and couldn't understand why this woman was always so unhappy, and it seemed as though she was largely angry with me. I ran away at age 12, and I ran back to my father's house. I knew where he lived, and I was capable of getting there on my own bicycle. What was odd about this situation was when I ran back to the father's house, I was running back into a situation that was potentially very harmful to myself. The stepmother was very abusive to me and my brother, brutally so. But I felt that was a better situation for me than where I was with my grandmother. And in that household, it was not so much Catholic anymore, but it was that household under my father and my stepmother, and it was largely the stepmother who was going towards the born-again Christian thing. The book during the 70s that was common was called The Way. And I didn't really attach myself to much of any of that or what was going on. And then we relocated from Southern California to Northern California. And I was 14 years old when one day my stepmother said to me, "Wouldn't you like to meet your mother? Aren't you ever curious as to who she is?" And I was like, "No, not really." I never was. I just was who I was. And through the course of things, yes, I was a very disturbed little boy through the whole thing. But no, not really. But as it worked out, I did meet my mother. And after a few months of correspondence, she sent me a plane ticket from Massachusetts. And I flew out right after the freshman year of high school, and I met her. And soon afterward, moved in with her and her second husband and my two half-brothers, whom I had never met. And it was during the course of this time that my mother found God. She had had a lot of turmoil through the course of her life, and it seemed to me that suddenly this young man who wasn't in her life for 13 years suddenly was, and that was quite a jarring experience for her. And the way she found the answer to her problems was finding God and Jesus Christ and as her Savior and so forth. And I remember going with her to church and actually marching down the street with signs in our hands. And I don't remember what it was, but I prayed that nobody from high school would see me doing this. And it was shortly after this I realized this was not where I belonged. And I tearfully informed her one day that, "Mother, I do not belong here. It's time for me to move on, and you go on and resume your life the way it was." And I did, and I went back to California to that rather dangerous household that basically I fended for myself all the time, took care of myself, made sure I was fed and clothed and everything. And I was kicked out of the house at 17 years old. My 18th birthday present was a suitcase, brand new suitcase, use it. And religion and spirituality pretty much did not exist for me at all. I had no concept of what God was, really. I did go to church with a girlfriend of mine and her family, which was sort of a Baptist sort of thing. And I remember that just how it happened, my luck was, there was a guy talking about homosexuality and all the things that was wrong with it. And for the first time in my life, I felt like I really had an opinion on the topic. I got up and walked out. I want you all to see this. I'm getting up and walking out of here. I was 18 years old, 2 months out of high school, and really didn't have a clue, but I knew I didn't like what I was hearing. And at the time, I was actually just barely out of the closet. I mean, not even really out of the closet, but had just had my first sexual experiences, which I will say at this point weren't really... They were experiences, but for someone who really doesn't understand his homosexuality or his person, it wasn't really what I would call enjoyable, but they were what they were. I partnered myself with someone for 17 and a half years, and it was not until I was 31 years old, and AIDS came into our lives, rather abruptly and aggressively. And it wasn't the first time that I actually got down on my knees and addressed the concept of God and actually begged for anything in my life. It was when Kevin was in the hospital. He had been dying there for 2 weeks. And I thought at this point, there was a full moon, and I got down on my knees and I said, "If there's a God, please make Kevin well, and I will respond." And the next morning, Kevin showed his first signs of recovery, and he lives today. I followed through on that promise to God, and Kevin and I began attending a Franciscan church in Sacramento. And it is really customary with me. I really tend to throw myself into things. And we found ourselves being really helpful in their fundraising activities. We loved yard sales, and we had these massive... We were just fresh blood, fresh meat, whatever, but we got in there and helped them pull together these massive rummage sales that brought in a bunch of money, and we had fun. I did everything from the passion plays and mass every Sunday, Easter this, and Christmas that. And also to the degree that I became a lector, and I would be assigned a reading once a month. I would attend and do a reading, and, you know, as part of that ritual. And I really enjoyed that. And being the Franciscan, I call it Franciscan. I would never identify with being Catholic, but being this was a Franciscan order of the Catholic Church that really did embrace the gay community. Barry Brunsman, if anybody knows that name, he was the pastor at the time. And he was, ostracized for performing gay marriages. But that was that congregation. Until one day, and as is also characteristic of me, of doing everything at just barely the 11th hour and never doing my homework, I got to church on time, and instead of reading the missal that was sent to me a week ahead of time, I never even opened the envelope. And then when I got there, they gave me the fresh copy of the paper that, okay, here you go, here you have 20 minutes to practice. And it was something from the Old Testament, Leviticus. Mm-hmm. And I read it, and I was like, oh my God, this is a bad mistake. And there was no time to really do anything about it. I have a commitment, I'm going to do this. And I actually, it was really fun. I could go up there in tie-dye t-shirts and everything, and it was just like, some people would just look at me this way, but a lot of people really liked it. But I just went up there, this is my time, I'm reading this, this is how it's going to go. And the reading had something to, well, mostly it was about unclean people. And here I was, a person living with AIDS, and my body has been somewhat altered by this whole process. My ability to walk has been diminished by the HIV drugs. And so I'm reading this thing about unclean people and what we're supposed to do with them, stone them, put them in cages, or whatever it was. Oh, I just read that out loud with all the vile and disgust and hatred for what I was reading, as this made absolutely no sense to me. Why are we still doing this? And I finished, and I walked down the stairs really quietly, slowly. You could have heard a pin drop in that church when I was done. I sat down in my chair. Nobody moved, nobody said anything, until somebody finally picked it up and said, okay, we got to keep this thing going. I resigned immediately after that. I wrote a letter of resignation, and I dropped out of the church at that point. And my relationship was having a little bit of problem at the time. And this was around late 1999. And as we're all going through this Y2K buildup, like, what's going to happen? The world's going to come to an end and all this. And I'm like, forget it. Y2K, I know what I want to do. I want to be away from it all. I want to go somewhere where I'm going to be away from the mushroom cloud, or even better, I can watch the mushroom cloud. Well, it just so happened I had talked to friends of ours, a couple that lived up on a ranch in Auburn, and literally from their front porch, the way it was, there was a mountain there and a mountain there, and from, 40 miles away, you could see the lights of downtown Sacramento right there. So I knew it. Right there, I would get to see the mushroom cloud. But I got to see it a really different way, and something really remarkable happened that night. Kevin and I had been together for 15 years at that time. And it was Rory and Meech and Kevin and I. Rory said something to me that we were in their studio. We'd had this wonderful gourmet dinner, and then we were going to get really, really stoned and do artwork in their wonderful studio that we'd helped them build. And so we'd finished dinner, and me and Rory were down in the studio, and we're fixing the stereo or doing this, that, or the other, and he said something about sex or whatever it was, and something about group sex, and it was like a light went off in my head. And I said to Rory, I says, if you ever really think you want to do that, I'm here to tell you I'd like to do that with you. And that night, we had the most extraordinary four-way sex thing that was just incredible. I mean, we were at her for 4 hours. And that was the first time I ever had really sex outside that relationship. It was just cosmic. It just blew my mind. And so, you know, we just were crazy at each other, four of us, for all that time. And I remember at some point we're all just like going at it, and I'll just go like, we were just like, and all of a sudden you hear all this banging off in the distance, and we're like, oh, Happy New Year. And but it was a cathartic experience for me, because, you know, I was where I was at the time. And Kevin and I were driving home that morning down from Auburn, and he started sharing things with me that was like, why are you waiting till now to share all these stories with me? Well, so we moved on. And we began having more and more, obviously we're no longer monogamous. And we started having a lot more sex outside the relationship. And I began realizing that there was a lot more that I didn't know or didn't understand, had not yet experienced. At age 37, I started going to college. Now, back in when I was growing up, college was not even a concept for me. It was like, you go to school, you go to work, you leave, that whatever it was. It just, the idea of college was nothing that was ever even a concept to me. But 37 years old, I started going to college, learning American Sign Language, which was, to me, was another way of communicating with people. And another class that really was the bomb for me, a girlfriend had suggested it, was Introduction to World Religion. And it was being taught by this amazing woman who had taught at UC Berkeley for 13 years and somehow managed to find her way to Sacramento. But this woman was the bomb for me. She was so crazy. She didn't even stick to her class plans, but yet I loved her. I loved the wild and wonderful way she talked about religion, but she didn't even really talk about religion. It was simple concepts that she put across, like cause and effect. I had never heard of anything like that before, but it made such radical sense to me. And I think cause and effect was the big thing that really started putting it together for me. And then another amazing thing happened. At the same time, I'm like hearing these things from a classroom and books and whatever, or films this woman's showing me. Then I met a really wonderful person just by chance. And I should also point out it had to do with a sexual encounter, but Jim Stockton. Jim Stockton to me represented light. He had done so many things that I had not done. He had been to so many places. Asia. I mean, I had no idea what the Eastern philosophies were prior to that time. And Jim was who he is. He's full of light and generosity and compassion. And I fell in love with him. And he introduced me to lots of things and concepts. He happily took me wherever he went. I learned what Rinpoches were. I learned who the radical fairies are. I became acquainted with the Billies. And ultimately here in Gay Buddhist Fellowship. And as we all know, all things change. ... I was attending counseling at a certain point with George Hubbard. And I was dealing with lots of issues of grief and trying to figure out where I was on the overall scheme of thing. And this counselor we were seeing gave us a text. And the text was The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. And I was going to use that as one of my references, but I realized it wasn't actually entirely appropriate. But it was our homework was, when we went to visit this person, this counselor, we were to have read a chapter of his book and have discussed it, and then we would go talk to her about it. And I remember thinking the first couple of chapters of the book were very remedial. It's like, I know this. We already all know this stuff. It just didn't kind of dawn, like, this is crazy. And I don't know that his book had anything to do with it or where I was, but I liked, for the longest time, I like to say that what happened to me was happened to me just like Eckhart Tolle, but when I went to review his foreword, it didn't. Which was very interesting, because then I learned that here's that perspective thing. What I thought was, isn't. So, one day, and I'm not really quite sure how this happened, I'd like to think that I kind of fantasized it had something to do with a spring day, and it had just rained, and there was these puffy white clouds filling up the sky, and they parted. And then it was just clear blue. That's kind of how I envision it. But I had that epiphany about God and consciousness. And I'd like to read to you what I wrote to my one and only blood brother about this, because I sat down and I wrote about it while it was hot in my mind, what I had just discovered. I'll try to abbreviate this. It gives me the sense that you are all well and all is as it should be, ... And so it really is. You may recall an e-conversation we had maybe five years ago. I can't remember for sure, but I think I was still attending the Franciscan Catholic Church in Sacramento. I asked you if you believe in God. Your response was something to the effect that more likely God does exist, but you weren't quite sure what form, if any, God has. I think that at that time when I asked, I was attending church as a sort of spiritual path sparked by a vivid and what seemed to be extremely symbolic dream about our Father visiting me. Somewhere around 2000, I had some serious problems about human beings and with the Christian doctrine in general and left the church. Then again, is time really important? But I had a moment of clarity this past week. And I'm not sure how it happened, but it does from time to time. I figured out what God is. God is consciousness, clarity, and being in the present. That is, not thinking about the future, what's to come, or what has occurred in the past. That is, no sense of history. None of these things are here in existence to cause pain, anger, anxiety, frustration, desire, fear. This, along with the sense of awareness that you are connected with the world, all the living things, the environment, your ancestry, and what you have as a result, are feelings of love and compassion for all. Enlightenment? You are enlightened. We all are. Enlightenment at its highest point might be the euphoria one might experience when the above mentioned sense of God occurs. But it also has to do with just being a bit wiser than you were even just a moment ago. It's amazing how much wiser one can be at the end of the day than they were when they fell out of the bed in the morning. It just means that you've had another veil taken away from being between you and what is the truth. So what's happened over time is that man has created God in his own image to teach us how to become enlightened. But as only human beings can do, they screwed up God, gave him an ego, an angry one at that, and wove his own ignorant perceptions and values into a story and a doctrine, and thus we have religion. So how does one find God? Watch your mind. Watch how it becomes angry, happy, desiring, the ups and downs. Watch what motivates you. What are the reasons for what it is you are doing? If you find you're doing it right for the right reasons, if you're happy and not causing others suffering, if you're feeling love and loved, if you're watching your breath instead of getting angry, you're finding God. Want to go to church? Take your wife to the beach. You'll find God there. Unfortunately, religion, which was originally created to tell us the above lesson about consciousness, cause and effect, watching our psyche, our behavior, and accepting responsibility, instead gave us a deity to turn ourselves over to and ritualize it. There may be such a thing as a miracle, but we'd probably have a lot more of them if we allowed ourselves to see that there are more of them than we really think there are. It's interesting to reflect now, after all the years of knowing Nadine, my brother's wife, as an atheist, What does that mean? One who doesn't believe in God? Oh, okay. What the fucking Wagnalls should say is enlightened one. That is, one who is comfortable enough with their own path so as not to turn over their destiny or fate to a deity modeled after an immature mortal being. Isn't that something? We are our own superior being. We are capable of creating our own heaven and hell. That was my first of three epiphanies that I had. And the second one came a couple of days later, that I realized also that, you know, while when I was in college and I took a class on sociology, I was learning about how we grow and so forth. And this thing about my mother leaving at age 2 years old meant that I missed out on a certain growing process there, bonding thing that happens. And I literally have had people that say, God, I've gone to therapists that talked about, and I tell them what my growing up history is, and they're like, God, I'm surprised you're not an actor. Well, I'm like, whatever. But I realized somehow I started putting things together from my life experiences that whether we like it or not, we are a part of our parents and our family heritage. And I realized that as much as I feel estranged from my mother, I really do like her, and I probably have more in common with her than I realized. And the third thing was, I always had this expression, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And part of me was afraid that I would actually grow up and not be able to keep that divinity with me that I felt when I had that epiphany. But one day I realized that I grew up. I realized that I had become what I really wanted to be, and that was Carl Lasagna. I'm really happy where the product of what my life experience is. I came to the realization that it all makes sense. All the pain and suffering has brought me to this point. But what is it that Carl Lasagna does that keeps him, why are you always so happy? Or how is it that I manage to keep that sense of when I'm walking down the street and I see a person and I can smile at them with this visceral knowledge that somehow I'm related to that person, that, you know, I can smile at them. It's very easy for me to do. And, okay, so how is it that, where am I at this point in time? And how do I define myself? And how do I keep that happiness? Well, I want to take a step back, now that I've gone over this sort of chronology of events, and kind of step back and look and say, okay, some people talk about their teachers and what create examples for them. I credit this room, the people in this room, with really helping me form who I am spiritually. George Hubbard for giving me the concept of perspective and potential and mindfulness. And when I talk about potential, there's potential everywhere. I don't consider myself a Buddhist because I don't conform to what I see as Buddhist principles. And George always talks about reincarnation, but he talks about reincarnation on a bigger scale than what I hear from a lot of people. And that is the possibility that when one reincarnates, not just as a human being, but as any living sentient being. While I don't believe that, I recognize and practice that there is that potential. David Axel, for the word unskillful, I have learned so much from using that word. To Harv, for sharing with us the spiritual properties of cocksucking. He's the first person that's really talked about that in this room, and we talk about what our experiences as gay people are, or as gay entities are, or spiritual beings. My spiritual practice, I consider myself an ecstatic. Which really, this whole thing about how I grew up and didn't attach to my mother or any particular household or ritual is a gift to me. I've figured this out because it allows me to be an ecstatic. I've never learned what complete control or self-control is or any such thing. I've never really learned that. I'm just out there. Just like this talk. It's just going like this. It's coming out. But there's this other thing. It's cosmic erotic ecstasy. My spiritual practice is through sex. I'm not really afraid to say that I'm okay with the idea of sex addiction. Now, whether I'm really actually addicted to sex or not, it's not really... To me, that's not relative. What's relative to me is that my way of keeping with the divine is finding the divine intimately with other men. One instance that was really formative for me or affirming for me was just last year, January of 2000, January 2006. For the first time, I read the book by Jack Kerouac, On the Road. At 43 years old, I read that book for the first time in my life. And I really, really identified with that man. I was like, I get him. It's not like he was teaching me. It was like I've heard so many people talk about Kerouac when they were in college and they just decided, well, that's what I want to go for. Well, the fact of the matter is I did that on my own. I started dealing with repression in my own way in 1993 when I painted my car psychedelic. That was my own way, that was the first big step I took from breaking away from the norm. I just don't fit in any category in any way, shape, or form. But that was the beginning of me accepting that I don't need to be in the norm. I don't need to dress the norm. I don't need to drive the norm. I don't need to live the norm. I can be my own ecstatic self that way. So anyway, I just really feel that I'm comfortable with that. I think it's a good way to be. I think it's a natural way to be. I always found it kind of interesting when people would be drawn to me and say, well, I like your energy. They had no idea what they're talking about. And I think a lot of people kind of recognize that aspect of ecstasy in me before I did. I've learned a lot about being in the present. And there's one anecdote that I would like to share. I was driving in the car with my boyfriend a couple weeks ago, and he says, I have a confession to share with you. And I said, oh God, who'd you do that? But it wasn't that. He was confessing to me that he was feeling jealousy and a couple of other feelings that he wanted to share with me about how he felt about me wanting to have dates with people or talking about them. Okay, so there's three books that I thought I was going to... I'll come back to that, but there's three books that I go by. There's I thought it was the Power of Now, but the other one is the Ethical Slut. And another one that I learned from a fisting buddy that he lent me was the Divine Androgyne. Now, if I were to define myself spiritually, I would define myself as either A, an ethical slut, or B, a nudist Buddhist. And I'm really very serious about that. Well, as serious as an ecstatic can be. But anyway, so he was telling me about this as we're driving in the car. And I'm just kind of like breathing through as I'm hearing this. He's telling me, he's sharing me with, I feel this, and he says, I'm feeling like it's competitiveness and my own stuff like this. And as I'm sitting there in the car, I'm just kind of breathing through this, and I'm thinking, wow. I'm just listening, and I stopped. And I waited till he was finished speaking, and I said, you know what's absolutely amazing about this? I says, you know, normally I would have felt like I had to rush to, like, catch you from feeling fear or jealousy. Or there was that desire to rush to catch, to make him not feel what he was feeling didn't happen. I didn't, nor did the response of defensiveness come up. And I couldn't believe what really did arise that really made me happy and made me feel like I had arrived, that I could be in the moment. So what had arisen? My cock. By my lover telling me his feelings, just for the sake of being able to tell me his feelings, my ability to sit and listen to them and just listen and allow things to happen and not get like, oh, sweetie, or, you know, whatever, and just let it happen. And what arose? My dick. Wow, that was really something for me. I felt like I really can be in the present. I'm doing okay with this program.
Excuse me, Carl. I'm very hesitant to interrupt, but we've reached a noon hour.
I'm done.
We're going to need some time for a few questions, and then we'll do our usual announcements. Can we entertain a few, a question or two for any questions from the floor for either Doug or Carl? Then let's thank them both for their candor. And we come to that phase where we ask for other announcements. Anybody have an announcement?
Well, I'm the host today. There's cookies and apples covered with lemon juice. And there's a Donna bowl going around. That's the donation bowl. Suggested donation is $5 to $8. More if you can, or if you can't, that's fine, and I'll carry that around. There's a sign-up sheet, pink sign-up sheet, so if you'd like to stay in touch with the Sangha, please sign up. You can get the newsletter by mail or by email. And we also have a GBF directory, which is everyone's name and address and phone number. If you want to be on that, you need to signify that on the pink sheet, and that's distributed regularly. If you offer some kind of service like massage or plumbing or whatever, you can put that on the sheet too, and that'll go in the directory. And afterwards, please wash your teacup. If you there's tea also available. If you drink it, please wash your cup and put it on the rack to dry. And afterwards, people usually go out to lunch, and they sort of tend to gather toward the front door around 12:30.
My hands won't do it the way they used to, but if anyone sews or stitches or knows someone who sews or stitches and wants to investigate the idea of a stuffed Buddha for children from, say, 2 to 4, not a money-making scheme in the slightest. But if anyone has talents and wants to investigate that idea, I'd be happy to discuss it with you.
Yeah, I wanted to announce again, 2 weeks from this weekend, there's going to be a three-night lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender meditation retreat at Saratoga Springs. It's going to be led by Larry Yang and Anushka Fernandez, who are both students of Jack Kornfield. And it's a beautiful facility, a couple hours north of here, Saratoga Springs. And it's going to be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. And there's some flyers out there. And SaratogaSprings.org, I think, is the website where you can get more information. It's reasonably priced, and there'll be ride shares. And so if anybody's interested, it's a good way to...
What was the date again?
It's Martin Luther King weekend, the 18th, 19th, and 20th of this month. It's two weekends away from now. It starts Friday evening and breaks Monday afternoon.
Dean?
Hi, I'm the present speaker coordinator, and next week we actually don't have a speaker. We're going to have open sangha. So come along, and we will break into small groups, and the facilitator will lead us in topical discussion or discussion about what's alive for you. And actually, another head of mine in non-sangha life that I lead is I facilitate year to live groups, which is an opportunity to meet with a small group of people for a year once a month and practice living as if it was your last year, which is actually quite a freeing experience and helps you learn to both live and die in body. So I'm actually going to start a gay-specific group. So there's some flyers just out there. If anyone's interested, you can pick up a flyer and contact me.
Okay. I'm set. Yes.
My name is Bill. I pick up the mail for the group. I want to let you know we've received around $1,400 so far in donations from our annual appeal, and Community Thrift has also sent us a check for about $330. So I encourage people to keep recycling your used goods through them and letting them know to apply the donations to the GDF. Thanks.
Well, let me say thanks one more time to our speakers, this morning, Doug and Carl. And if we could gather in a circle, we'll have our...
By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness that is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, and live believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.